Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY.
Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
fighting. Right now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now, right now.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live at Aristo State Community College. I'm sorry, not community college. It is a university, one of our only HBCUs. So we are getting ready to do our thing here on Black Radio Hall of Fame. And I do want you to know that the opinions expressed on BRHF are those of the program host and not necessarily those of Aristo State University or BRHF Radio. So having said that, it is a lot going on in the world today, you all. More than I know you want to deal with, but we're going to zero in on a particular area of the country. And we have with us today James P. Comer, and this brother is the founder of Architects of Justice. And we're going to talk a little bit about what they do and then what's going on in Baltimore. So welcome to the show, Brother Comer.
Thank you. And it's John P. Comer. You've never called me James before, so I understand. Yeah. I know that.
Okay. James P. Comer. Yes.
No, not James.
I said
James.
It again. I wrote it. It's stuck in my mind now. I said, changed it in my notes to John and still said it. So that lets you know that the brain won't necessarily do what you command it to do immediately. But anyway, I'm going to make that mistake again. Okay. Brother Comer, welcome to the show. And I'd like to talk about Architects of Justice for a minute, because to me, I'm a word person. And so the name itself evokes some intentionality about how we have to build. And so when you're an architect, there's various aspects of building that you have to consider. So talk a little bit about Architects of Justice, what you all do, how you chose that name.
Yeah, so I started Architects of Justice in 2015, and I come from a family that did a lot of different designing. So my mother was a teacher in the sector of what they used to call BEH, which was a lot of students that before they would get kicked all the way out of school, they would put them in BEH programs.
Okay. Here they would be called alternative schools. Mm-hmm.
Right. Uh-huh. And that's what they ended up calling alternative schools. But back then, at that point in time, it was BEH. And, my father had a background in engineering, and one of my brothers is deceased and passed away, but my brother that is still living, he's an actual architect. So I kind of grew up in a household. But at that point in time, he was drawing a lot. He did a lot of drawing. And, I had wanted to go to school to be an urban designer. And, but the way the police and the system impacted my life, it pointed me towards fighting for justice for ourselves. Mm. And I ended up just kind of taking whatever design, structures of design, and putting stuff together and went into community organizing. That's where I came up with the name. I've been organizing for nearly 25 years. I've done it in different cities across the country. I started with the group ACORN and was in New York City organizing. And after a while organizing there, they sent me to Chicago. They sent me to Philly. They sent me to a bunch of different places. And like from those experiences of seeing and engaging and organizing with people in these different cities, it provided me a outlook and ideas on that just improved me as an organizer.
Mm-hmm.
I've also worked in the death penalty reform and abolition movement with death row exonerees, as well as murder victims' family members, passing legislation in North Carolina and Maryland. And so, you know, at the end of the day, Architects of Justice, we do a lot of trainings, capacity building for organizations that might be low on capacity, leadership development. But I also had a flexibility to do what I feel like is needed, that needs to be done in our
mm-hmm,
community,
mm-hmm.
So that, you know, my hands aren't tied in any specific area. So, like, you know.
You can pivot when you need to.
That's right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think there's a beauty and almost a privilege when you are in a household with people who are constantly creating. Because
indeed.
Then you see what it means to start with nothing and end up with something. And I
indeed.
Think sometimes it's hard for people imagination to go there unless
right.
they have that socialization and that inspiration. But, you know, I know that that's the case, and you end up being more capable of being imaginative and creative once you know what the possibilities are, because you've already seen it happen with people around you. So that makes me even more respect that name and the mission of that organization, because it's rooted in a very special place. Because I think when you look at our community, that you said that you wanted to be a community.
Urban design.
And here's the thing with that. You see our communities and what they look like.
Right.
Somewhere there is no blueprint that folks are following.
Right.
It's a mess. But I know that people who use or understand a land use plan or understand urban design, they start with a plan, not just you start throwing stuff here, there, and everywhere out helter-skelter. So,
right.
you know, I'm almost regretting that you weren't able to go into that, because I think you would have been a real asset in terms of, you know, designing the kind of communities that we envision that are healthy and whole for us to live in.
Well, very briefly, the reason why I didn't do it was once I began to find out that you have to be at a certain level to be able to create those designs. But once I began to realize that urban designer position for a lot of folks is just an administrative position, and you're following someone else's lead.
Mm-hmm.
And that urban design still pretty much falls under like a white supremacist lens.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I didn't want that attachment. You know, ideally I had the idea that I could go in, design communities how,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that, you know, but you know, you get into these city government jobs, state government and all of that, and you know, you still
yeah,
have
and
to
you
answer.
See the, you get that reality slap upside the head.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, so you found out that you were more effective outside of those confines. I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you. So,
you know,
go ahead.
The work called me, like the you know, being harassed by police officers starting at the age of 10 years old, and it never really stopped. It never slowed down. And growing up in the neighborhood I grew up in, although, like, you know, my parents, they did well for our family, not too well, but well enough. But we still grew up on the South Side and was surrounded. I had, you know, so many different experiences in life. So I saw that my experience compared to so many other people's experience was being, living in an oppressive system. And I felt it,
mm-hmm.
whether it was through education, being suspended from school and all of that for different reasons or no reason at all,
mm-hmm.
you know, Mm. It called the rebel in me. Mm. You
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
As it will do.
Yeah.
Because I think you and I have similar kinds of, transformative changes in our lives in terms of where we ended up and what we wanted to do. So I just marvel at anybody who can stay the course. And when I say stay the course, that doesn't mean you keep doing the same thing. It just means that it's a liberatory course. It's for liberation. And so wherever that takes you, that's what you're going to do. So that's very inspirational. So I know my listeners, would like to hear about the Marilyn Mosby saga. And I say that because, we just, you know, last year, they pretty much ran our first black female prosecuting attorney out of her office. She had won the first election and then came, so it wasn't a fluke when she was reelected, but she did a similar thing that, Marilyn Mosby did, and even the sister in Georgia, and that is they came out saying there's not going to be anybody above the law. And in our case, Kim Gardner then took on Greitens, who was the Republican governor, who on his own, like, self-destructed. And so she really never got a chance to put him in court. But the audacity of her even wanting to do that and attempting to do that was pretty much her downfall, because then she had a target on her back and they pretty much harassed her. So now we hear that Marilyn Mosby, you know, got, you know, convicted of, you know, what I would say is not a huge crime, but she is no longer going to be in that office. Can you tell us about the charges that she faced and what happened?
Well, you know, I tell you this, like, and I'll start here, like, and it kind of starts where you said it started with in St. Louis. So, you know, when she decided to indict those officers during the Freddie Gray incident, it put a target on her back.
Mm-hmm.
And there were groups and all kind of interest groups, political groups that came out against her and probably put the magnifying glass on her in so many ways that you know, they finally got what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know all of the details of her situation, but it was something regarding, I think a vacation home that she didn't report, to the state or whatever, or she used some funds out of her retirement, retirement fund to purchase it, and then she may not have reported it or something like that. Like, at the end of the day, like, it's a result of those magnifying glasses being put over the sister for standing up in the right way and in the legal way for our communities. And so they, you know, found her guilty of whatever charge that was. And I believe she has house arrest or supervised probation for a year, which I'm happy that she'll still be able to be with her family, her children and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, you know, what I think the ultimate goal was to remove a powerful figure, that was willing to stand up and do right by the law and our community, and to get her out of the way. And, you know, I think there have been other cases like that, in the city of Baltimore that where there's just been a removal of, black officials, for different reasons and different capacities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Over the past 5-10 years, it's been a good amount. And you know, one was our prior mayor, who was a black woman. You know, she was sentenced to prison and later released. I think, who she appointed as the police commissioner, they got him on taxes, not paying his taxes. They got him out of there. So, like, you know, the one thing I know is, and the one thing I've learned about Baltimore, because I've been here for 15 years. I'm not a native, but definitely have been in the trenches organizing, is that when a city, a black city particularly is being gentrified, that also includes, city office positions, state, any state positions. That includes position of power. It's not just the community.
Mm-hmm.
It's some of these positions that people are residing in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to say that they were doing everything right, but, it's a clear overhaul or attempt to overhaul, black Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. A take back. That's what it is. Cause I mean, we sometimes jokingly say we can't call Washington DC Chocolate City anymore because it's been gentrified. It's more like, you know, some kind of malt city. But, you know, I'm thinking about Marilyn Mosby and I have a special place in my heart for her because she, along with at least 8 to 10 other reform prosecutors, came to St. Louis in the first few years of Kim Gardner's term to support her. And I stood side by side on the courthouse steps with Mosley and some of the other folks. So, and she was one of the speakers. So, you know, when I was looking at her, I was thinking about these like really bold, you know, women that were like taking on this office, at the behest of their communities, because basically we know what the prosecuting office has done to our communities in the past, and we've had no love for them. But then here comes some black folks that say, we understand the pain. We understand the reality. We are not here to continue mass incarceration. We're not here for foolishness. We're here for justice. And we're like, oh, okay. So across the country, it was all these, you know, free reform prosecutors that came into being. And I have a picture of them all standing together across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And when I looked at that the other day, I wondered how many of them are still holding office. I think it's going to be interesting to do that. I'm going to do it. I don't have time right now, but I am going to do that. I know people like Larry Krasner is still in Philly doing his thing, but he's white, a white male, but he's doing his thing. But I wonder how many of the black women are still there. So that's going to be an assignment for me to do that. And I'm going to report out what I find, but I think, you know, across the country, just based on what you said, is that, you know, the folks that are standing in the way of these folks taking back power, taking back communities, taking back the coffers, the public coffers, they got to go. They got to go.
So there was something that you said that kind of led to my second thought on the situation. And it was, these folks taking positions that usually were polarizing to our community,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I'll say is this. There were... when she was under attack, I don't think we did enough as a community to step up and protect her, right?
Mm.
There were people that did step forward. There were some groups that did step forward. But like what we have to understand, as a community is that like, when these folks get into office and they go against the grain in that way, there's going to be a backlash and we need to be there to try to protect them as much as they're trying to protect us.
Right.
And that goes for myself as well. I think there should have been a lot more being done, publicly from our communities to say that, like, we know you're trying to railroad this sister. We're not standing for it and being able to protect some of those folks that go in the office and go against the grain, because some of the same backlash we'll get for being on the ground for fighting and some of the same things, if not more, that they're going to get
on
their side.
No, I think that's an excellent point to raise up, because and we talk about it a lot in movement spaces, like you can't just elect people, particularly reform folks, no matter if it's a state rep or congressperson or whatever, and just leave them. Because if they're going to do what we sent them to do, they're already a target.
Right.
And so for us in St. Louis, we did have an organization that initially was about supporting reform in the office, not necessarily Kim Gardner, but we ended up having to really support her. And so we led the efforts for, you know, re-election. We had protests at, you know, the city hall and wherever else it needed to be. And I think we did our due diligence, but you know, in the end, it's only so much somebody can take, and she, you know, voluntarily resigned. And so it's just like, it was just relentless. And I just don't even know how she did it for almost 8 years, just relentless. But I do want to give people a sense of Baltimore, because I know you've been there long enough to know the ins and outs. But, you know, at one point, St. Louis, and Baltimore would be referred to literally in the same breath. But, and I think it's because not only of the demographics, but St. Louis has lost so much population in the last, you know, the last 50 years, but definitely in the last, you know, 30 years, we've been hemorrhaging. So I think you all are still at about a 500,000. Well, we're under 300,000 people. So, yeah, so, you know, I'm calling it now a big town. I don't know if it's a big city, it's a big town, but yeah, so I think some of the issues are there in terms of, you know, police brutality. I mean, they're the same. But what I want you to talk about to the Baltimore, because sometimes people are a little bit geographically challenged. Even though Baltimore is on the East Coast, it was south of the Mason-Dixon line. So it's got southern flavor. So talk a little bit about what's unique about Baltimore in terms of that historic place that they have right there on the East Coast and being part of really a contentious slavery boundary.
Yeah, well, you know, the state of Maryland is a place where Harriet Tubman lived, and they hold her up high. Frederick Douglass was very instrumental here. But at the same time, you know, there were slaves that was dropped off, at what they call Fells Point, which is like advertised as like a touristy destination to come to. And, you know, this was also the first city in the country to actually, legislate redlining and make it legal. Mm. So there was actually, you know, a law put in place that allowed for redlining.
Wow. So there's some history I don't think we knew about.
Oh yeah. Wow. Without a doubt. And so, you know, but at the same time, what I see is also, a strength and an underlying strength of the black community here, because a lot of black folks came here, found freedom, found their jobs after, you know, slavery was done, and it may not have been being as strongly enforced here, but then like that's where a lot of the laws started being put in place to continue to oppress the black community. So any city where there is a large population of black folks, it just evolved into a plantation of oppressive laws. It went from a plantation of slavery to a plantation of oppressive laws. And so because of the potential of what it could be, in regards to black power, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, you know, just like a lot of cities, we've experienced the highway that was built to nowhere, the highway that split a black community, and they never finished. And to this day, it's still sitting there, not complete, but they built the highway through part of the west side of Baltimore and split a neighborhood that was together. I mean, like the drugs that are brought into the port here, heroin was a big thing, and the drug addiction here, it's tough. And I've worked inside of some of the schools here, and just the not to say that, like, there are definitely committed teachers and principals that I've worked with that I know some of them would have given their lives for those children, but systemically, the buildings that they work in, the structures, No air conditioning. You can't drink the water. The water is dirty. No green space. No gyms in some of these schools. No football field. No options to play on football teams, basketball teams for some of these schools. To where, you know, at the end of the day, some of these schools just end up being a place to eat for some of these kids that won't get food at home and pretty much some kind of daycare that protects them from what they might experience if they stayed in that neighborhood.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, the system has completely broken down the black community here. If you ask me, because of the potential of strength that it bears, I think it's the same reason why they didn't wait too long when the Freddie Gray incident happened. Like, they called in the National Guard, like, within a split second, and I'm standing in one of the public housing. I don't know this is going on. It's about a mile away. I'm standing in one of the public housing structures named McCullough Homes, which is actually depicted on The Wire, the high rise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm standing there because that's one of the places I was organizing. And then suddenly I see a caravan of Humvees and tanks roll up the street.
Mm.
And, you know, they're sitting out the top of the Humvees with the guns out and everything. And so, like, you know, a scene of that rolling through one of, America's, black cities, you know, it was, you know, for me, it was heartbreaking. It was all kind of emotions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then, you know, and I'll say this and I'll stop. And then, like, juxtapose that situation and the tanks in the streets and they're protecting the malls, right? They're not, they're making circles around the malls and the city halls and stuff like that. And then, like, fast forward to COVID, and I'm in another public housing project called Cherry Hill in South Baltimore, and I see the same vehicles coming to now give aid, right? Like,
what a contradiction.
What a contradiction. And this time, the guns on top of the Hummers was covered up by tarp. And so, like, and it really threw me for a loop. It was one of the only times in my life to where I felt like my wires were crossed so bad that I didn't even know, you know, I'm looking at the soldiers like, and they don't know why I'm looking at them like that, but, you know, it's, I tell you, the dynamics that we have to deal with in this country, and not just deal with, but experience and live through, you know, it leads to so many of the issues that we're experiencing and going through, and some of the anger that we have, and we may not even realize that's part of the burden that we carry.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you're just joining us, this is Jamal Rogers, your host, Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here talking with James P. Comer, and he is John P. Comer.
So let me help you. There is a famous James P. Comer, a black, I believe he's a black psychologist.
And you know, I asked you where you related to him, and so I think it's like
balance. That's why we're,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's it.
John Comer is with us, and he is sharing all the similarities that we know exist here in St. Louis, and I would say probably a number of the urban cities across this country, and how that it's not some kind of mystery or accident that people at a certain point get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I remember you all had your rebellion after the Freddie Gray incident. And so,
right.
So we're just going to keep repeating this stuff until so people see that there is some solutions to this, but if you don't address the underlying issues of the anger, of the resentment, the trauma and the hopelessness that we're going to keep getting the same thing. So, you know, it brings me to the point of talking about reparations. And, you know, my listeners have heard from, Nkechi Taifa and, you know, Cam Howard. They also heard from folks on the commissions, both in Kansas City and in St. Louis. But you all also have a reparations commission, and you're not necessarily on that, but you do, you have made this film, and I think the film is pretty, a pretty powerful, justification as to why, sure, reparations are appropriate, you know, necessary, and, yeah, so talk about Pay Up.
So, yeah, the film is called Pay Up, Get Out the Way. It's about 32 powerful minutes, long, where, the idea of it came from, maybe a group of about five or six of us, decided to come together, and we were meeting, in my office, and we were talking about, like, raising money, to begin to do some work around wealth transfer, reparations type of stuff, right? And like we, you know, like we're sitting down and we're coming up with different ideas. Many of them are good, but like the amount of funding that you're asking for compared to the mountain of issues that we're trying to address, just never, it never panned out.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the process, I began to go back to a lot of the neighborhoods that I very deeply organized in and kept relationships with a lot of folks, during 2013 to 2017, 2018, and, began to ask people about how they felt about reparations. And, you know, I got a variety of different responses, but ultimately I came to the conclusion that, if we had the opportunity for reparations coming in the near future, we wasn't really prepared for it because there were so many different thoughts on what reparations is.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, a lot of folks just kind of thought that it would be a check and a check alone. And so I went back to the group of folks that we were, coming together with, and, I said, look, we need to do something like a documentary. And the documentary needs to be educational on what reparations is, on who has received reparations. It needs to be motivational on mobilizing folks, organizing them and being able to mobilize them. But we need to make sure that folks know that this is a legal argument and this is not emotional,
mm-hmm.
right? And, we need to make that plain and simple, so that people can begin to feel more, comfortable in the advocacy for themselves, because there's a lot of people still to this day that's scared to say the word reparations out loud publicly, right?
Right.
And, but, it's being talked about in Congress. It's being talked about in San Francisco. It's being talked about in St. Louis, Detroit,
mm-hmm.
Asheville, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, we need to be organizing, educating ourselves and having these, discussions so that reparations won't be given to us by folks who decide what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And really it's just another government social program.
Right.
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 And so that we can ensure it's not reparations. And then in the case of, and this is how I always explain it, so many of us have been doing reparative work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing it in the different sectors of oppression, right?
Exactly.
Whether it's been education, criminal justice, environmentalism, you know, however you want to name it. And so we have to ensure that, like, when we talk about reparations and when I talk about it, I talk about reparations as a mansion. And criminal justice and policing is a room in that mansion.
Mm.
Housing,
mm.
housing is a room in that mansion.
Mm-hmm.
Environmentalism is a room in that mansion.
Education.
So we have to, indeed, education is a room in that mansion. So we want to be able to ensure that we're addressing the mansion and not a room in that mansion as we have been doing, already, right? And we need to be able to have these conversations. So, we've been doing these screenings, throughout the city, at Black-led organizations and Black-owned institutions, and they brought out an average of 40 to 50 people per screening, and then we'll have a discussion after it, and the discussions have been so powerful, so unifying, so educational, to the folks in the room that has created good energy
mm-hmm.
for us to be able to move forward and continue to organize in some form or fashion. And it just so happens that, like, the Legislative Black Caucus in Maryland, some folks from that Black Caucus are actually talking about putting forward a reparations bill at the state level. So all of this, more than anything is almost feels like our ancestors pushing us now, and calling us to stand up and move forward, because, at the end of the day, it's almost like it's now or never.
Mm. I think I feel the same way, and I've expressed this to, you know, when, Kichi was on with Cam, I'm like, it's just this feeling that, you know, I've never heard so many conversations about reparations, and of course it's been around for 40 years, maybe longer than that in terms of what, Congressman Conyers put forward. And I said, this is the most organized, not just talk, but actual organizing that I've seen. And I feel like you, if not now, when? And the fact that there were, black mayors who signed off on reparations, and maybe they didn't all know what it entailed and what it was going to do, but it started to activate and engage people in a process. First of all, to learn what the heck is, you know, reparations and what does it mean, because the root word of it is repair. And to your analogy about the mansion, you know, you can build one room, but the house is still falling down. So I don't want to get hung up on the check. I think, you know, we deserve check, because that's what, you know, some of the recipients of other reparations have gotten. You know, your family was personally affected, but then you got the whole systemic impact. And I think if we only get the check and never deal with the systems change, then it's just going to keep repeating itself. So I'm interested, John, in what some of those conversations were about reparation. Were they mainly in favor, but people didn't quite know where to go with it? Or were there people that were saying, we don't need reparations, you know, folks ain't going to do nothing with that money, but give it back to the white man? It was
all of the above and more. And it was from one end of the spectrum to the other. It was from, you know, a few people actually saying, you know, a few people in their, I believe in their 50s, have said, like, you know, I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know what reparations, and my mouth kind of dropped, right? Like, but, you know, she stood up at the end and said that, and thanked us for the education around it. And then there's people that's like, alright, what we gonna do? Like, what's next? I'm tired of talking. Let's go, right? So, and then there's, it's every point in between. And what I tried to do was create, like, I would have thought leaders from the city, mostly from the city, and getting their ideas on what reparations is from their perspectives, from the work that they do. And we also brought in, like, black economists, and so, like, to talk about that money situation. And so at the end of the day, what was pretty much said was, reparations as a country for black people, if we got what was owed to us, we would bankrupt the system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. So ultimately, like, what some of these conversations did was take a wide open dialogue and begin to put some borders around it, which we need in helping to get down to the details of it, so that it won't be thought that, like, hey, we're gonna get $7 trillion check because that's what's owed to us. Well, like, the country won't even be able to foot that bill, right? Like, so, alright, so let's talk about what those numbers may look like, along with the policy changes, the land that needs to be returned to us, right? Let's talk about, like, these different areas into what that looks like. And so, like, these conversations kind of help to push the conversations further along. And, you know, we're still in that process. But like I said, you know, the state of Maryland or the Black Caucus is looking to put forward a reparations bill, and, like, that's part of what all of this, the film and all of this was about. So that just because it's labeled reparations and just because it's put forward by, you know, black folks that we know, that community input needs to be there, from people that are informed to say, you know what? That's not enough. Or, you know what? That's good. We like that, right? Like, so, you know, that's kind of the hope that, I have and a few, other folks, a lot of other folks on the ground have, to help push forward this conversation because, I think to a certain extent, like some communities, man, like some folks outside of our community might be having that conversation more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we need the, like, the brothers or sisters that's locked up need to be talking about it.
Mm.
The streets need to be talking about it. The dinner tables inside of our homes need to be talking about it. Wherever we are, we should be carrying that word like we own it.
Mm.
We should take ownership.
We do own it.
Right. And so we should be talking about what that looks like. And I've heard so many different ideas that like, you know, just things. I mean, ultimately what these community conversations have turned into are like think tanks. That's really what they've turned into.
Mm-hmm.
And they've brought forward like good dialogue and good ideas and good conversations. So, you know, we're continuing to move forward and planting those seeds. And, we haven't released the film yet. We're still doing screenings, but we have gotten requests outside of the city to show the film because that's how powerful it is.
Right.
And, you know, we can discuss, myself and you can discuss, like, if you want to do a screening out there in St. Louis, then we can get that set up as well. Cause the film's going to resonate. Although it's like people from Baltimore that we interview, just like you said, Baltimore, St. Louis is mentioned in a lot of the same sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And, it'll resonate. We just showed it in Philly. You know, we ended up getting accepted to a film festival in LA for it. So it's a well put together film.
So remind me if Baltimore has a reparations commission.
So there is a reparations commission, and so like one of the architects of that commission is actually in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a group, here called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. It kind of reminds me of
those folks,
right? Yeah. So they helped to design that reparations commission where people sit on it and, marijuana tax, kind of similar to what's happening in Evanston. But like if folks don't know, there's a conservative advocacy group that is suing the city of Evanston for giving that money out.
Mm. Surprise, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it just shows that it's going to be a fight.
It's going to be a knockdown, drag out fight.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. So
I got a question for you, John, because, you know, I believe in self-determination and I believe that the, situation on the ground is different from city to city, town to town, and so those folks have a right to determine what it looks like for them. But one of the concerns is that we don't have a national plan. If some cities are more organized than others to get what they need and others aren't, what does that look like for the struggle for reparations, you know?
So, you know, what I've seen is that is over the years, we've been either siloed by, personality, we've been siloed by funding, and we've been siloed potentially because you're working on a different issue than I'm working on, and I don't have time to do, to support what you're doing over there because we're so focused on this over here.
Mm-hmm.
So first, like the word reparations and the talks about it is like a call to action within itself. And what I'm seeing is that it's bringing us together across those silos in ways that I haven't seen. And so I just think naturally if we we focus on planting seeds and educating our folks on what reparations could be, those conversations are going to lead towards a place of gathering and unity to where we can then mobilize around some things. So it's going to take thought leaders, everyday people, you know, all of this to make it happen. So like nationally, and I feel like the documentary that we made can actually serve towards lending towards, a national conversation, a breaking down of the silos to where, you know, people are wanting to talk about this in places everywhere. So I think what we need is organizers that are paying attention to that energy and paying attention to these discussions to then begin to tie this together. Because, you know, as you and I know, like, community organizers are like pretty much one of the most important pieces in our liberation, just period. Like we can't do this without organizers on the ground. And so like, you know, those organizers also just need to be in conversation with each other. That HR 40 bill that's in Congress. You know, I ultimately think that like I've met black folks that aren't for reparations. Oh, I don't need it. That's because a lot of times their personal situation, they're looking like, oh, what do I need that for? I'm okay, right? And that's also a misunderstanding of why reparations.
Exactly. I was just going to say that.
Right. It's a clear, and that's part of why the education needs to be done. But like ultimately, there needs to be a platform, a reparations platform put together that we move politically. And that's what black folks move on, reparations. Mm-hmm. Are you for reparations? Are you for the points in this platform? Are you willing to deliver this? And we just need to package that and move forward with that politically, you know, in our communities.
So here's the thing, because you made me think about what if we had a document that had been researched and said, here are the areas that have to change significantly if there is to be any forward motion. Because, you know, somebody might say, oh, you know, let's get, you know, a playground for the kids. Oh, okay, that's nice. But that's not one of the points on this matrix that says if these things aren't changed, then we're going to keep replicating the system as it is, and we're still going to be having issues. I don't know if anybody has done that yet, because I think to your point about having it national, that would rally people around a certain set of goals that are more research-based. And I'm going to have you respond to that, but I'm also going to say that with a number of the commissions that I've seen and the folks that I've talked to, there are people either on that commission itself, or they've asked folks in the academia to help research the rationale for reparations. And it sounds like, I don't know if the Baltimore Commission is doing that, but it sounds like what you have done with the Pay Up documentary pulls all that together in a way that's visual and powerful.
We attempted to.
Okay.
We attempted to. And, you know, I can't say it's exhaustive, as far as like reaching all points that we need to reach, but we tried to, as hard as we could within that 30 minutes, that 32 minutes. And, you know, and like the team of researchers, yes, then, there are so many that are already in place. We just got to call them together.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like I said, like we had the black economists come down from DC and speak on that. And you know, like you're a broadcaster from a HBCU. I'm sure there's an economist up there. We have to take, like Morgan State here in the city, and Coppin State was part of, the institutions that did, a couple of the screenings. Both universities did two screeners each. And so, you know, there has to be a room to where we put our minds together and come out with, something that we agree upon, and the organizers have to be out here, planting the seeds of education, getting the contacts of folks and calling folks together, to not just work for it at the federal level, but the state level, the city level, and there are also private institutions that have destroyed our communities. And, that's a conversation that needs to be had too.
And I was going to say some descendants are, you know, based on that are going after those institutions, which then makes it a very, quilted kind of effort because it's so many layers to it that people are trying to do. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I do think that we have to have some kind of overarching goals or, like I said, a matrix that says here, 3 points, 5 points, that if we don't see that in a reparations plan, then we're just going to be repeating ourselves and folks going to throw out some money. But, you know, 20 years later, another generation later, we still got the same problems we have.
Yeah, and we're going through inflation. So
yes,
when you're talking, you know, so we don't know what the dollar's going to be worth. We don't even know if the dollar's still going to be around. you know, so we don't want to fall for the okie doke.
Yeah, I'll take some gold bars.
Indeed, right? Right. You know, but land and the amount at one point in time there was, I think the country had, maybe about 20% black farmers, and maybe a little more. And then their land, and that was the land that they didn't want, most of it. And now I think we're somewhere around less than 10%. I could be wrong on those numbers, but you know, the loss of land, in the community and like, you know, it's just sad that people are fearful of black sustainability.
Right.
We're not trying to take over the country. We ain't trying to control nothing and take over the governor's office like that. We just want to have liberation for ourselves, to be able to take care of ourselves. And that's what other black folks need to understand too.
Really is based on the centuries of free labor and next to free labor that the wealth has been accumulated in this country. So all we're saying is like, recognize that we were a part of your wealth that you are, you know, using, in some ways against us. And we want our fair share.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, but there's so many different points of entry of organizing that we have to cover in this, but I think we are well capable of doing that.
Yeah, it's exciting to me. It's just totally exciting to have even a conversation that I didn't think 20 years ago we would ever have. I mean, I kept talking about reparations, but it just seemed so distant and it just seemed like it wasn't taking hold, that people didn't feel like it was worth fighting for, that it was going to be too much work. But now people are like, what about us? You know? So in the few minutes that we have left, can you give people where they could at least see the trailer, and where the website is to talk about what's going on? Cause I love the title, Pay Up or Get Out the Way.
So the website you can go to, watch the trailer and sign up for updates is, www.baltimorereparations.com. So be sure you're spelling reparations right. You might want to Google it. So be sure, so baltimorereparations.org, www.baltimorereparations.org. And, you know, you can get the trailer there. Feel free to share the trailer. We look forward to releasing it to where people could just have access to it.
That would be powerful for even the commissions that are in place that are still struggling to put together, you know, the data and the statistics, the historical piece of it that is going to be required in order to not just justify the money, but also to educate our people about, you know, why it's necessary and why we have to move forward on this. So James P. Comer, brother, thanks for taking time out from your Baltimore.
You did it again.
James, and I'm looking right at it on the computer.
Hey, at least you're mistaking me for another black person that is well respected in the community.
He is because I love him because he's a psychiatrist for children and he's done so much groundbreaking stuff. So, you know, I think in my heart of hearts, I was hoping that was your daddy. So. But the Comers seem to be on the right, you know, end of things and doing what they need to do for our community. So, you know, you say y'all not related, but I can't figure out how many Comer families are there.
Right.
Yeah, I think y'all might be related, and I'm gonna make you related because I keep calling you James. So, John, thanks, and we're gonna continue to keep our eyes on the documentary, and I'm actually gonna talk to the folks on the Reparations Commission here to see if that might be something they're interested in as well, so that we may do something similar. I mean, the whole thing is the replication means that, yeah, that was an idea that you all had and is working for you all in terms of creating the space for people to talk about it, educating, inspiring folks to move forward with this whole notion of reparations. And it's not going away. It's not going away.
It's not. And as I always say when I leave a place, may your urge to unite be stronger than your fear of betrayal.
Wow. Wow. I'm going to have to remember that one. That's powerful. That's powerful. But that's a good thing to leave people with, to just sort of sit on that and think about it before they say stuff, do stuff. Yeah.
That's right.
Right. Well, again, thank you for joining us today. And we definitely going to stay in touch with you. Wow.
Thank you.
So we got some announcements for you all because we, you know, I like to plan your time so that you are productive and you give it back to the community. So you all know what's been happening with the Civilian Oversight Board. You know, the state pretty much, you know, tried to take back local control of the police department. We beat that back, but they did make some changes for the Civilian Oversight Board. But, you know, we got a hearing coming up on June 13th. That's Thursday. It's both virtual and in person, but they're going to introduce the nominees, for the civilian oversight, because that process is closed. All applications have closed, but these are the nominations that are going to be moving forward. So you get a chance to meet these people who are going to be on the COB and asking questions of them, because there is going to be public comment. So make a note of that, June 13th. That's also the same day that the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression is having their monthly meeting, and I'm sure there's going to be some discussion about that hearing at that meeting. They're also going to finish up some of the discussion from last month around abolition, particularly around mental health. So mark June 13th on your calendar. But before then, unfortunately, you all, the state has planned an execution. Dave Hozier is, you know, subject to execution next week. And then, you know, before they even got that ink dry, they set an execution for Marcellus Khalifa Williams. And this is in spite of the fact that, you know, that brother is innocent of charges. And in fact, the St. Louis prosecuting attorney has, you know, submitted a motion to vacate. And yet the state still is saying, we're going to kill him anyway. So his is in the fall, so we got time to rally around that brother. And I just want to make a point here around executions. Dave Hozier is not saying he's innocent. He did the crime, and he's been doing the time. What we say about cases like this is that we want to commute the sentence so that they get life. You know, executions are so barbaric. We're asking for commutation. But for Marcus Khalifa Williams, we're saying this brother's innocent. The documentation is there. We want to rally around him. So I need you to go to the website for Missourians to Abolish the Death Penalty. There's more information on both of those people, and as well as what you can do to support them in those efforts to for us to have a humane way of dealing with folks who do crime. But yeah. The state, we just about, I think, cleaned out the death row, because they, you know, they, I guess they're trying to get it in before the election so they could say they did something, but, it's kind of sad. It's really sad. This is the last week for the Black Repertory Theater's Timbuktu, And if you haven't seen that, you got to see it. It is fantastic, you all. The costumes, the music, the acting, it is the bomb. I would say it's probably the best one for the season. But we got one more left. We got one more, production left and we'll see. But I'm thinking that was pretty, pretty fantastic. The other thing that's coming up is the Black Griot Museum is having a, what's called, Lift Every Voice. And this is an inspirational exhibit based on a national group of women who have, hand sewn these rugs. So that ought to be pretty, amazing to see. Reception is going to be June 8th at the Griot Museum at 2505 St. Louis Avenue. So a lot coming up. And next week, we're going to get the lowdown on what happened in the legislative session. And so, we're going to have a panel that's talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so we definitely want to tune into that. And if you missed anything, you all know that you can go to the website, JamalaRogers.com, and you can pull up any of those past radio programs. But until then, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the battlefield.
Right now, the time to do the right thing.